recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of Review Less and a special advisor with Jurnov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you want to download it and play it on your iPod, iPad, computer, whatever device you're listening to it or storing the show on. Today we have a real interesting show, which I'm thrilled to be doing. We're going to examine how a company used benchmarks and e-billing to create a much more efficient legal department and to establish measures by which they could show cost savings, return on investment, and other techniques to show other corporate stakeholders how efficient the legal department is. While a slight stretch from the e-discovery world, cost containment is something which everyone in e-discovery understands. We might be able to learn lessons from the Rockwell Automation example and deploy them to the electronic discovery world. I've also invited an electronic discovery consultant to discuss the ins and outs of doing an effective RFP. Lisa Germsheed is the Law Department Administrator and Project Manager at Rockwell Automation. The majority of Lisa's career has been devoted to working with legal technology. She's worked in the legal environment for the past 25 years, spending the first 5 years in various law firms, and the past 20 years in a law department setting. Prior to joining Rockwell Automation in 2005, she worked in the staff attorney's office of St. Paul Fire and Marine Insurance Company, now Travelers. She's a lifelong resident of Wisconsin and a devoted Packers fan. Unfortunately, Lisa, Kevin and I are both Jets fans, so we won't hold that against you. Rockwell Automation is one of the world's largest industrial automation companies serving automotive, food and beverage, including dairy, personal care, life sciences, oil and gas, mining, and paper and pulp markets. The company's architecture and software unit offers factory management software and motion control sensors and machine safety components. The company, with annual gross revenue of $4.8 billion, has approximately 19,000 employees. Kevin Esposito is both an MBA and a JD. He's the managing director of Rivulex LLC, where he drives the analysis and implementation of processes and tool sets that are designed to decrease the cost of complying with legal discovery obligations. Kevin's a member of the Electronic Discovery Reference Model, EDRM, where he currently co-chairs the Model Code of Conduct Subcommittee. Kevin was previously co-founder of the discovery response team at Pfizer, Inc. in New York and helped to lead Pfizer's corporate records retention efforts. As the director of electronic discovery at Pfizer, Kevin was responsible for the day-to-day operation of the IT side of their discovery process and coordinated all electronic discovery worldwide. Kevin knows firsthand the dynamics of internal communications between information technology and legal staff. Kevin developed and managed global technology support organizations for the United Parcel Service for over a decade before becoming an attorney. For the past 12 years, he has been finding innovative ways to apply computer technology to business processes within the legal arena. He's a frequent speaker at legal and technology conferences and specializes in bridging the communications gap that exists between business people, technologists, and lawyers. He maintains offices in New Jersey and Massachusetts. Kevin was also the million-dollar bill in my original eDiscovery board game, Discovery Land. So, Kevin, great to have you on the show again, and Lisa, nice to have you on for the first time. So, I always like to start my programs by asking how you got interested in electronic discovery, but for this program, why don't we talk about interest in cost containment? And, Kevin, you can talk about cost containment and electronic discovery specifically.
Okay, well, electronic discovery has grown in both stature and in interest in the past 10 years or so because of the amount of money that corporations are having to spend in order to comply with the regulations that say you need to provide all the information to people either in investigations or litigation. For the longest time, the discovery costs were hidden as a fraction of the legal department's budget. Years gone by, the costs really weren't that large. There was a lot of paper copying and things of that nature. It was fairly simple. But when you get into collecting and analyzing and stripping information from computers and doing all kinds of analysis on that information, you begin to get into much larger numbers. And obviously that gets onto the CFO's radar. And once it's on the CFO's radar, they're saying, well, I'm not willing to accept just a bucket charge saying this is the legal department cost. I want to know how those things break down. I want to know what are the drivers. I want to know where are the areas where we might be able to make some savings. And you start asking some very specific questions, and at least in the discovery world, very specific data was not being captured for the longest time. So when you come in, you start talking to someone, an organization calls us in and says, hey, we'd like you to help us to cut down the cost of our legal environment. We'll say, great, well, what are you spending? And you find a lot of very large miscellaneous charges or a lot of block charges for law firm A, B, and C. And we have to start working with people to try to break those things down. So cost containment is very big for everyone these days. The economy's just been terrible. And in order to be a good corporate citizen, the legal department has to step in there and say, okay, let's take a look at what we're doing and see where we can cut back on some of these things.
And Lisa, how about for yourself?
Well, in 2004, when our general counsel came on board here, the first question he asked was, how much do we spend on outside counsel? And back then, we had a bunch of old homegrown systems capturing accounts payable data, and the law department actually had no system in place for capturing data about our matter spend. So the answer to that question was, I don't know. And he put together a team of finance people to try and dig up that total. It took them about 3 weeks, and when they came back with that total, it was shockingly high, not at all what he expected. So he started to think, well, I think this is going to be our first task. We can't really manage spending that. We don't even have any awareness out. So he decided that he was going to have to do something and do something pretty quickly. And after we got that report, we started benchmarking against other companies, and it was confirmed that that cost was really high. So that's the reason why we decided to tackle that.
And how about yourself personally? How did you get into the sort of cost containment area? Was it just this project, or did you have an interest in it before?
Well, I actually wasn't even working here at that time. So I think you were leading into kind of what was your first step, and leading into that part of our discussion, the first step was that he consulted with an expert. So he hired a consultant who did a study of our processes and systems, met with the legal staff, and produced a technology roadmap. And the roadmap suggested that we implement, they had a whole list of things that we should implement to become more information-enabled and synthesized. And one of the other recommendations was to hire me. So there was a search, you know, put out for me and also a records manager. So those two positions weren't here when he started looking at these costs. So that's how I came on board, and one of my first tasks was to implement e-billing. So the consultant had suggested things like e-billing matter management, business intelligence reporting, IP management, corporate entity management, document management, knowledge management, and some way for us to collaborate within our team because we're a global team. So I was hired the next year, and we implemented e-billing first. So it took us about 6 months. And since then, all those other things that I listed are actually now in place. Our most recent project deployment was SharePoint 2010 with document management system. So we're actually almost completely well-rounded.
That's great. Maybe we'll touch on SharePoint in a little bit for e-discovery. But Kevin, as a follow-up, can this type of an approach of top-down analysis be effective for electronic discovery?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, electronic discovery is simply a section of the legal department's responsibilities. One of the complaints that I've had the past few years is that the tail is really wagging the dog in the sense that there's been so much focus on e-discovery as an entity and what you should be doing there that organizations begin to lose the holistic approach that they have for any other business department. They focus on this one slice of legal operations as opposed to looking at legal operations as a whole. And one of the biggest problems for any operation is simply finding the information. It's great to say I would like to save money on something, But if you don't know what you're doing, if you don't know what your processes are, if you haven't done the kind of analysis that Rockwell's done, if you haven't taken a look at the people, the process, what you have in place currently, then you really can't put together that roadmap that was discussed. You need to have a roadmap. You need to have a plan. And putting in an e-billing system or putting in something that helps you to track the activities that are going on is going to help you to have that factual information that you need in order to work with both your internal experts and any outside experts that you might engage to come up with a plan to make some improvement.
So, Lisa, the transformation of your legal department and the additional capability you now have sounds real impressive. I'm sure that you learned some lessons along the way from the process. Are there any tips you can offer to help others try this successfully?
Well, it's kind of tricky. I think that people tend to rush things, or they're too conservative and they make something drag out too long. And so trying to find that balance is really, really difficult. So I found that really you really need to take the time to really assess and select that vendor that you're going to work with. Really make sure that system is going to cover most of your needs right out of the gate. Just, you know, I think that people, these companies, they had either homegrown systems and they just weren't really doing what they needed them to do. So they think, well, they're going to go to a commercial system, and then they go to this commercial system and sort of slide back into that feeling that they should have this be more like their homegrown system. And so they try to make that commercially available product really, really customized. And I think they do that too quickly. So you should really do the best job of getting something that meets most of your needs, get that deployed, start using it. And I think what you find is that you don't really need a lot of those customizations. The product was well thought out, but perhaps some of your processes are a little flawed or need to be updated, and that's what we have found. And so is, you know, close to the center line as you can get with using that product, when the product is enhanced and other things come out in newer versions, you're not going to have as many problems dealing with that all those little customizations that you had. So, you know, I always compare it to when someone would buy, if you bought Word, let's say, you're not going to sit there and be complaining about it can't do this, it can't do that. You make it work for your department or your function. Nobody has a homegrown word processing system. They all buy Word or something like it, and they make it work. So that's kind of my philosophy or my analogy around this kind of a product implementation. So that's what I would suggest.
Great. Kevin, you know, drilling down deeper into the e-discovery area, are there any sort of similar lessons you can impart for cost containment in e-discovery space? My sense is that there's probably less tools available to try to do this as there are just in overall legal management. But, you know, what's your sense?
Well, I think that's true. There are less tools to specifically tackle the e-discovery area, but I think that's where people go astray. Stop looking at this as being e-discovery. Stop looking at this as being a section of the legal department. This is a business process, and you need to look at the overall business process and break it down into its component parts, and then look at what are the cost drivers within each one of those parts. There aren't specific tools that will help you on the cost containment of discovery, but there are plenty of financial modeling tools that are out there that people can use, and there's plenty of tools that are out there to help you on managing your data. So between the two of those, you should be able to get everything that you need. I have to agree with what Lisa's already mentioned. You need to make sure that people are doing something. Don't spend all your time in analysis. I see a lot of organizations get paralyzed because they're trying to figure out, okay, how do I find a specific tool or a specific consultant or something to tackle this particular problem, and they're too busy doing that rather than focusing on the internal issues that they need to take care of. There's probably going to be some low-hanging fruit that they can grab immediately, and those initial small wins really drive a lot of enthusiasm from the people internally to say, okay, yeah, maybe we need to change what we're doing if these are going to be the kind of results we can expect. I agree with what Lisa said as well, is about not trying to customize everything that you're bringing in or everything you're working with. When we're working with a large corporation, we usually tell the stakeholders, no one in the meeting is going to get everything that you want in any system or in any process, but we guarantee that people won't get any less than, say, 70% of what you think your overall needs are. So it really is a bit of a negotiation that has to happen between internal partners. It's a bit of discussion and analysis. As Lisa said, you need to take a hard look at those processes. Maybe it's the process itself that's causing you the issues. You know, when you start buying software to mirror a process, or when you start taking software that's been created by another organization and you start customizing it, taking it out of its comfort range, you really have to start scratching your head and saying, do we really want to do these things? And a lot of times people will do that because they haven't really done that analysis. So sitting down, doing that analysis, and then after you have your targets, going out and trying to map them as close as you can through that middle-of-the-road sort of approach is probably the best way to handle things.
Okay. Good advice. Now, why would someone want to do this? I think we should probably talk about maybe some of the successes you've realized, Lisa, from this type of approach.
Well, I think that Kevin put it – he just put it exactly the way that I would state the whole 70%, the whole dealing with the change management piece of it. But if you look at it from dollars and cents, of course we put in an investment in putting in the system, and I'm just talking about e-billing just as a start. And one of the things that we saw immediately was an immediate cost saving. So we had this report that the finance team put together after 3 weeks, picking and choosing all the costs from all these different payment systems, and now all of a sudden we have everything in one place. And that first year, it was a little bit of a shock. I mean, some things we had maybe some predictions or hypotheses that we had drawn about different matters or groups of matters, practice areas, and how much they cost, and so there was a little bit of a shock. And also a lot more insight into this firm and what's their average cost per timekeeper, how much are they charging for their partners, and in that venue, does that make sense? Is it, you know, a law firm in Indiana, is that really how much a partner should be charging us for that type of work, for example? So that first year was kind of that year of learning and really starting to find out where we're starting from. But then after that point, I have a really nice chart that shows this nice downward line. And if I look at that first year where we had that manually created report, and I look at maybe 4 years later, it's actually half. The spending is cut in half. And so that was our best case scenario. We also insourced more work, and there are some other factors that came into it, but half. I mean, 50% is a pretty sizable reduction. And so that was our best case, but I've seen at least the spending is around flat, or we also measure it against our revenue. So we kind of expect if our revenue goes up, that percentage of outside counsel spending as a percentage of our revenue is going to go up, and it should be at least relative. So that's what we've seen. I consider that a success. All of that other data, we may talk about this later on, but and I think we do. Just allowing us to become more creative with fee arrangements and such. So we've seen, there's no question, I never have to explain our cost in great detail because everyone, all the leaders in the company know that we are managing it to the nth detail, and the system helps us do that.
You know, it's interesting, and I hadn't thought about this until you said, but once you throw a metric down and you capture data and you look at it, You oftentimes have an oh my God moment. I mean, things just jump out at you. So it's somewhat unrelated, but I just created a test for document reviewers called ReviewWrite and began testing in a couple of markets. And immediately, when looking at the results, was like, oh my God, there's a range of results here between reviewers, and they're all experienced, so they're all on projects. This is interesting.
Right. So just think about it. You were
a lot of analysis. It's just like, oh my God.
Right. So you were kind of just flying by the seat of your pants before this, right? You're just guessing. You're just thinking. I think this is how it's working. And right, when you see it all down, you know, in a nice, neat format, it's a little bit. It's a little bit eye opening.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everyone interviews for their reviewers instead of doing any testing, which is sort of. You know, sort of like a light bulb moment to think, why don't we do a test first? But anyway, that show's not about that. I'm just, you know, the thought of looking at numbers and saying, oh my God, is something that I feel palpably because I just did it in the last couple of weeks. Kevin, have you had those types of moments in eDiscovery?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when we began looking at e-discovery as an issue and began breaking down the processes and then began looking at the things that were driving costs, a lot of times the questions simply weren't asked. You know, people didn't ask, well, how much are we paying per gigabyte, or how much are we paying per reviewer, or how much are we paying, you know, per hour on specific tasks. And when they began looking at it, they said, we're paying how much? You know, they were kind of surprised by some of the numbers that we came back with. And, I mean, when we began our organization, we used to be paid by percentage of savings. And that sounded really great to a lot of corporations to say, well, I'll save you X percent of your e-discovery budget, and then work with them to figure out what that was. And then they started getting really upset when they realized exactly how many dollars that turned out to be. So, you know, it's been an interesting ride in the sense that from an area where nobody ever asked any questions and nobody ever attempted to have any sort of a metric, once people began looking at it, things started to change. And I think that's why you've seen so much cost compression in the industry these days, you know, where people, when I first started in e-discovery, people were paying anywhere from $3,000 to $5,000 a gigabyte to process information. Today, they do it for $200 or less. And the reason is people began asking questions. Well, you know, what does it take to do that work? And when they realized it was simply a computer sitting in a corner crunching numbers, they said, wait a minute, you know, how much does it cost to run that computer, and why am I spending $2,000 gigabyte in order to have people do this kind of work? It's the same thing with every other process that was out there. Once people started looking at the processes and once they started asking questions about what they were being charged, they were in a better position. Likewise, today, as people are looking to buy new services, people start asking questions about, well, what are people trying to throw in here? It's like going to buy a new car or a used car and being told that they're going to throw in undercoding for free. You say, well, wait a minute, well, what's the value of the undercoding then if they're just going to throw it in for free? It's the same thing with e-discovery costs. And, you know, when people say, I'll do all of your e-discovery as long as you let me handle the review, people start saying, well, wait a minute, you know, you've been soaking me then for years on all these other pieces. Is there really no other value here? And they have to have some very hard talks with the people that are both current and potential suppliers as far as, you know, what goes into this, what do you require, and how can we help you to be successful? Because nobody wants anyone to go out of business. People want you to be there to service their needs. So how can we do this in equitable fashion so that I can go back to my CFO and say, we've got reasonable costs here. We're not being soaked on anything. We're taking a look at this. And the work we've done in the past 5 years or so has been great in working with our customers to be able to say, here's where you were, here's what you actually were paying, and here's where we can try to steer this to a little bit more equitable level.
And Lisa, I mean, it's been very interesting hearing how you've done all of this. Have you gotten granular enough to tackle e-discovery costs yet, or might that be phase three after hearing Kevin talk?
Well, it's definitely going to be phase three, and Kevin said something interesting earlier about the old days kind of not really having a great need for e-discovery. There's a lot of paper copying and things like that, and we have a team here that is really, really excellent at risk management, and they're constantly monitoring our risks, and of course e-discovery is high on the list, but while they're monitoring this, we're actually still in a position where we have some space to continue to assess all the options available. So I think our experience with deploying all of these other systems is going to be really helpful when we finally get to the point where we have to engage someone outside to help us with an e-discovery situation. But right now, knock on wood, we're pretty set.
Good. Well, Kevin, this struck me as being somewhat related. I know that we've talked a lot and tried to work together within the RFP space for e-discovery. How do you create an RFP that saves money without just hiring the lowest price vendors?
Well, the first part of putting together a good RFP is making sure that you've got a plan for the RFP. We get called in, and quite often I'm handed what's called an RFP, and it's literally a one-page document from the outside law firm that says, Dear vendors, we're interested in doing some electronic discovery work. We have 2 terabytes of data, and we need it done by the end of the year. How much is this going to cost? You really need to work with the outside vendors and provide them with a little bit of granularity. So in order to provide them with that granularity, you have to know that ahead of time. You've got to know what kind of costs you're going to be looking to track. You're going to need to know what you expect to pay for certain services. You need to know what it is that you need to have done. Do you only need to have data processed, or do you need to have it hosted? Do you need to have someone provide you with a review platform? Do you need to have reviewers and space and computers and everything, or are you going to use your own people or maybe your outside law firm's people? There's a lot of planning that has to go into it, and very rarely do we see that planning happen. We're called in because people say, I got seven different RFPs back, and everybody quoted it seven different ways. So the first question we have to ask is, well, did you give them any guidance as to what you wanted to see? So getting into a standard format is a good thing for any organization to do. And by standard format, I mean something that the organization can reuse. If the legal department works with their own procurement people, you'll probably find that there's a template of some description that is in use for getting services for other parts of the organization. So there's no reason why you can't use that exact same process or system and adapt it to what you're doing in the legal area and say, okay, let's lay out here exactly what we're expecting these vendors to come back with. What kinds of services are we looking for? What kinds of costs do we need to have them explain? And once you've got that template, let people know, since litigation and investigations and discovery in itself is something that happens time after time after time, well, it's a repeatable process. Well, do that with your vendors. Make sure you're using the exact same process with your vendors. And, you know, we have an opportunity where we work with people. We do have an online system that provides them with an online marketplace to be able to compare these things in real time. But people don't need to go to that extreme if they don't have the docket that, you know, requires that sort of intense investigation. If you're doing one-off projects, put something together. Put together a template. Put together the information and give both your internal people and your external vendors some sense of security, some sense of having a control on the process that they're not seeing different formats each time. They're seeing a regular format that they can rely upon, and so that when you're looking at vendor A versus vendor B, you're comparing apples to apples as opposed to trying to say, okay, you know, I've got this all-in number over here and I've got all these individual charges over here. How do I compare these? You know, give some guidance to the vendors and let them come back to you on an equal level.
Lisa, obviously when people try to focus on finding a vendor or a supplier, there's always a focus, especially in this market, on price. How do you handle the risk of buying the red light special? You know, what are your thoughts on price as being sort of the lead variable?
Actually, I was just talking to a coworker about this, and I asked her opinion. Do you really think that our department has focused on the red light special and price? And she thought about it, and she said, no, we actually don't. And I remembered reading something. I cannot remember who the author of this quote is. I'm probably going to be paraphrasing it too, but I read that somewhere that when you purchase technology, you get three options. Is it cheap? Is it good? Is it fast? And at the end of the day, you only get to pick two. So if you pick cheap, you're going to get one of the others. And so it's either going to be cheap and good but not fast, or cheap and fast but not good. And I love that quote, because anytime I try to apply it to something we've done, it's absolutely true. So sometimes, you know, I looked at something that was really expensive and the value wasn't there. Other times I looked at cheap, and to be honest with you, if we had just gone into this without a whole lot of thought and decided to go with an e-billing vendor, there was a vendor out there that was very inexpensive and very fast to deploy, but it wasn't that good. But it probably would have been okay at the time, just to kind of like your starter program, but we would have outgrown it, I think, and we would have ended up deploying something else and sort of putting that one aside. But we don't tend to go with the lowest price. I'm kind of proud of that. I feel like we make good decisions. And to kind of go with something that Kevin said earlier, we do use our sourcing department because they're the experts on that. And they do have some really good templates for RFPs, and we supplemented that with demo scripts that I would write. So when we had the vendors come in, we had the RFP plus the demo script, and we would ask them to demonstrate really specific things, some of the things that we knew we were going to need to do with this program, And it's nice to see them respond to that and say, we can't do that. And that's when you decide to go back to, well, is it our process or is it really a need? Or, you know, at least I can compare it to the other vendors that come in and do their demonstration and make a really good decision. So we definitely never go with the lowest price. It cost, obviously, is something we like to save money, but it is not the driving force when we make our decision. Happy to say that.
Just gives you a lot of predictability and, you know, a sense to figure out what your ROI is with your business strategy or legal strategy. So good points. Kevin and then Lisa, I'm just curious, do you think these systems typically favor the large supplier or do entrepreneurs who might be more creative win with the systematic approach to finding more value from your suppliers?
Well, I think if you've got a systemic approach to how you're handling things, it's going to help you to sort the wheat from the chaff, and that's good for both large vendors and small vendors. Large vendors, you know, it's the old, what they call, no one ever gets fired by hiring IBM sort of situation. Some large vendors that are out there have been riding their own coattails, in a sense, because they've been riding off of their name, and they've got a large name in whatever industry it happens to be, and it happens in the legal industry as well. And those organizations have gotten a bit lax over time. They've gotten a bit, you know, fat around the middle, like all of us. And they have tended to ease off of their controls. Therefore, their costs climb, and they're just passing those costs along to their customers. And if you are a small supplier, then and if you really don't have the bandwidth, that's going to show in the way that you charge for things and the way that you react to pricing models. So on the other hand, if you are a lean and mean organization, and I always stress that, you know, lean and mean is fine, but what I usually find is emaciated and pissed off. So you don't want that. You want to make sure that people have the assets that they need in order to make things happen. If you've got that out there, that's going to show in your pricing as well. And if your pricing is better than the large organization's pricing, it's going to be a factual kind of analysis. So smaller organizations can compete with larger organizations if you're saying, look, I'm simply going to tell you what I'm going to do and how much it's going to cost. I'm not going to give you all of this nonsense about, oh, I've got all these wonderful experts I can pull from and this, that, and the other thing. If that's not what you need, tell me specifically what you need, and I'll tell you specifically what I can do. So for the large organizations, if they've got an advantage, it's because they may have some pricing advantages due to their size. For the smaller organizations, if you're entrepreneurial is great as long as it's the entrepreneurial bent that allows you to cut costs internally, which then allows you to turn those savings over to your customers. So both types of organizations can win.
And Lisa, your experience?
Well, I think that it sort of depends on the company. And I don't know, maybe this is just my opinion, my experience, but if you're a really large corporation, it feels like they tend to go to really large vendors, large suppliers, and we're sort of medium, maybe even small, and we have less of a budget. I really don't have any staff. Everything that we've done here has been done with very, very small portion of our IT time, so we're kind of almost our talent is insourced in the law department. When I started looking at vendors, and of course you always look at the big leader in that industry, and I want to see what they can do. They've got lots of bells and whistles. They had a large R&D budget. They've really perfected their product, hopefully, right? But when it came down to it, it felt like, well, of course it was more expensive. But when I found a vendor that was more aligned with our goals, we worked together really well. So I have a vendor that manages our e-billing and matter management, and they really like. We have a really great relationship because they appreciate my innovation. They know that their system may not do that yet, but they rely on their clients to sort of help shape the future of, you know, their development. Versus having a software company that has really large companies, and they maybe have little higher demands. And I found that when I went and looked at these larger suppliers, they were really geared towards maybe a specific industry. So it could be financial institutions or bank or engineering facilities or pharmaceutical, or it was a large company. And we're a manufacturing company, and that makes our practice very diverse. So we needed something that was a little bit more flexible. So finding that maybe medium-sized or lake-sized vendor worked better for Rockwell.
Okay. Kevin, one of the questions I want to ask for you, Lisa, is after you select vendors and law firms, from looking at your study, you then seem to have moved into some more creative arrangements. And this, to me, sounded a lot like how the automobile suppliers and car manufacturers partnered together, over the golden age of the American auto industry to create winning solutions. Can you talk about some of these outcomes?
Well, when we specifically talk about e-billing and just managing our matters here, I think I have to stress, first of all, that we talked about it a little earlier, until you have your aha moment, until you have a couple years of data in your system, you're not ready to have conversations with your vendors about some really specialized fee arrangements and start working on coming up with some mutually beneficial arrangements with your law firms or other legal vendors. So first of all, I think if you rush that, you're going to feel some surprises and maybe get your hands burnt a little bit down the road. So we waited a couple of years, and so now, a couple of years into it, you have things like average cost per case type and past vendor performance, matter evaluations, average timekeeper rates, how much time does the partner spend on the matter, what's their staffing model. And you start to also see, obviously, the results that they were getting on your matters, whether it be patent prosecution or a litigation matter. So after you've had a couple of years of that relationship, you start to develop that sense of trust, and you need that also. So you need the data and you need the trust, because now you're going to start sharing some risk. And after we had the couple of years of data, we were armed and ready to have those conversations. So we have so many different alternative fee arrangements, we wouldn't have enough time to talk about it today. We started out with the basics, so maybe it was a certain body of work and we could come up with some fixed or flat fee arrangements. And we learned some lessons about that, because when you start to come up with too basic an arrangement, you lose your data. So if we said someone could just charge us $10,000 for a matter and they don't have to give us the detail behind it, I just gave something up. And it may have seemed like a good idea. Boy, that's easy for the law firm. They don't have to get into detail in their billing. But the truth is they do, actually, because they're measuring it in their system, and then we aren't. So we're not able to see who really worked on the matter or how much time they really spent on it. So we learned, we started out small, and then we became really adept at combining different alternative fee arrangements. So we started getting to some success-based arrangements. We would say, here's the cap, here's the budget for this matter, and if you come in at 80% and you get this result, we'll split the difference. I'll give you a 10% bonus. And so that's mutually beneficial, right? And we can't make those decisions until we start to see how much we've spent in the past. We can benchmark against our own data. And I've seen so many successes. And really what ended up happening, too, that I've seen over the years is our list of law firms that we work with, the top 10, let's say, they're starting to capture a lot more of our spend as a percentage of the total. So I might see the top 10 are actually managing 60% of our matters and our spend. And then the other 200 is the other 40%. So they're starting to rise to the surface and starting to see that, we're fair, they're fair, and we're all, we're saving money, they're still earning a profit, and at the end of the day, everyone's happy. So it's really starting to become lucrative and really interesting, and like I said, every week someone else comes up with a different idea and we just make it work, because also we know how to make that e-billing system work. I know that the tricks and the tools that we need to make sure that it's not more cumbersome for either party. So it's working out quite well.
Kevin, we heard Lisa talk about you need to get your metrics first in place, and then you need some trust to try to start working together. If you look at the electronic, to really become innovative and creative as partners, but if we look at the e-discovery process of trying to get vendors, are you seeing more just cost containment and dividing and conquering approaches aimed at driving prices down that are out there? I mean, what's your perspective on where we're at in this, you know, a buying approach that Lisa described and comparing it to e-discovery?
Well, I mean, you're going to see dividing and conquering, and you're going to see a lot of division only because you've got people operating in an environment that they're not used to operating in. And that is, I usually tell people that I'm a pretty good attorney, but I'm a really lousy accountant. You know, a lot of attorneys that are out there that are working for their firms, attempting to cut down their spend on various areas, are really being told to do something outside of their comfort zone. They're being told, you know, stop being an attorney and now be an accountant, or now be a process engineer, or now be an operations management person. You know, you start taking a look at what the legal department is doing, and you're just being told, here is a number, and I want it down. And that's really the instruction they get. So because that's their instruction, they go out with that mindset. All right, the number is $100 right now. I have to get it down to $75 in the next 6 months or something of that nature. And the only way to do that in most cases is to dictate terms. And I think Lisa's point about having 2 years' worth of information before you go out and try to do anything innovative is terrific. I can tell you most of my clients would never sit for that. I usually have to fight with them to let them tread water for 1 year. If they don't have detailed information to go forward and do some negotiation, I say, well, you have to track your actuals then. You know, let's start from today and move forward and track the actuals and see exactly what we're spending on some of these things and work with those items and try to get them down over time. The problem that you face is that by the time the CFO is barking at the GC, you know, people are expecting to see something move immediately. So a lot of organizations will come back and say to their law firms, I want a 5% across the board price cut or something of that nature. Or they'll say to their outside vendors, you know, whatever you're charging for a particular service, whether it's processing or collection or review, whatever it happens to be, I want a 10% immediate price cut. Otherwise, you don't get any more of my business. And that's really counterproductive because of one word that you mentioned earlier, Carl, and that's trust. When you come back to someone and say, I still want you to work for me, but I need to pay you less money, therefore I want X, that really doesn't get people trusting you all that much. If you're going to work with law firms, if you're going to work with outside service providers, in order to gain their trust and let them understand what it is you're working towards, you need to show that you know what it is you're talking about. And the only way to do that is to have that base information. The only way to be able to get those people to realize that they do need to change their operations as well. I mean, you know, no outside organizations can turn around and say, oh, sure, I'd be delighted to have a smaller bill from you each month. If you turn around and say, wait a minute, you know, I'm paying $100 for X right now. The national average is $72. We need to get this more in line. That's a bit more reasonable conversation with the outside people. So, you know, divide and conquer is going to happen. Dictating terms is going to happen. Is that a long-term strategy? Absolutely not. But you have to, and as Lisa's pointed out, you have to have some very good historical data so that when you go to your outside organizations and say either that you're looking for a lower cost per unit or you're looking for a different way of billing for these services, you've got to say, I know what I need. This is what I need. This is what I'm willing to pay. This is what I think the marketplace is offering. What can you do? Because I like the work you do for me, and I want you to continue to do it, but we have to reach an agreement on price. And every business is the same, and I get a lot of pushback on this from law firms, but in the end, they realize that this is true. Every business is the same. You have to negotiate as a smart businessman, and no one's going to walk away from the table if there's enough money to be made by working with a client to satisfy the needs that they have. Because remember, it's the client that hires you. You don't hire the client.
I remember looking at your report on that was distributed on the impact and how you brought out your analysis of your department, that you actually sat down with your top 10 firms and showed them the results. And now you said that their percentage of business is actually growing. So clearly you're working together.
Right. It goes to show that, you know, we can work together and everyone can still at the end of the day be happy with the costs that are realized or the income that's realized. But I do that top 10 review, and it's very interesting. And I thought that we were going to be kind of like the parent-teacher conference, and and that the student was going to be upset by what was discussed. But the truth is, it was so powerful. The conversation was just really a success, and the law firms appreciated that we were tracking that information and sharing it with them. We didn't hide anything from them. And the truth is that the sophisticated law firm has pretty good systems in place, and they're tracking the same thing. So sometimes it's not much of a surprise. Maybe it's more surprising that the law department's getting that sophisticated as well. And so the conversations are going to start changing.
You know, I had one last area I want to ask a question about, and it sort of came to me a couple days ago. I was at an ABA conference on eDiscover in New York, and you know, for about the fifth conference I've been to in the last 6 months, a whole bunch of statistics and metrics were shown on using more technology, you know, machine-assisted predictive coding, machine-assisted review, different types of approaches with results. And the metrics are really compelling, but even the judges said they're not seeing it, and clients or law firms generally don't seem to be doing a lot of this. Is there anything unique about lawyers and metrics that cause things not to progress quickly sometimes? And I know both of you might not have an opinion on this, so we might have silence, although Kevin, it's never silent when a question's asked.
No, I think that there's probably an answer there. I think you have to look at numbers being tossed out to an organization like a legal department. You know, there's all kinds of numbers that are out there, and I think it was Mark Twain that talked about lies, damn lies, and statistics. You know, numbers can be skewed any which way in order to make an argument. And I think most lawyers already know that, which is why they tend to discount things like polls and investigative reports that say 50% of people said X, simply because you know that can be argued, you know, two or three different ways. So just throwing numbers out there and saying, oh, you're 30% more efficient or you're 25% more cost effective or something like that, I don't think that's really going to win anybody over. You've got to look at the effectiveness, and there's one thing that I think Lisa touched on that we really haven't discussed, and I think the main thing for lawyers is going to be defensibility. And you've got to know that your defenses are in place, and, you know, back to your discussion about not going for the lowest cost item, it's the same sort of situation. You're not going to use the most effective IT processing gizmo if it isn't something that is going to be legally defensible. You know, your defenses have to be sound. I ride motorcycles, and I will never forget the sign that I saw in one motorcycle shop above a whole bunch of various helmets, and it said, if you have a cheap head, wear a cheap helmet. And it's kind of the same thing in the legal world. You know, if you want to use a cheap process, or if you want to use an IT gizmo just for the sake of being able to say, hey, I blew through my document 17 times faster than anyone else, you're going to look a little bit silly if you walk into court and then you lose the case. Or if you walk into court and the judge says, I don't like your process, or I don't like what you did here, and I don't think that this is legally defensible. So I think it's really the issues of seeing that these things are accepted by the judiciary, and seeing that there is a combination of both time and cost savings with acceptance. Once we begin seeing more of that, I think you'll probably see greater adoption of some of these things. But until people can see that they are not just trading their defensible case for cost savings, that's not doing anybody any good.
Okay. Well, that's all good, you know, advice, and those are, I think, a good statement of the challenges that are out there. Lisa, I don't know if you have any final advice, having listened to Kevin talk a little bit about eDiscovery from your experiences. If not, that's fine, too. I think it's been a great show thus far.
No, I don't really have anything to add, because of the whole eDiscovery thing is just carved out from my radar here, so I don't have much to add, but I'm thinking my colleagues probably would have had something to add about that.
Well, we'll have you back when you do phase three of your program that you've put in place, and can talk about the results on eDiscovery. But this has been great. I think you both have been very helpful for our listeners. So I'd like to thank both Lisa and Kevin for joining us here at ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later in the year. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can also remember our show and website phonetically, as it sounds out, is Easy Bytes of ESI information. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Durnov, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. This is Carl Schinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.